Lawyers hired by the city of Cincinnati have finished a months-long investigation into Teresa Thigge's leadership as police chief. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, their conclusions, plus the surprise conclusion of a First Energy bribery trial. Then could some talented Reds rookies help the team conclude this season in the playoffs? Joining me now to get our news review started is WBXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you. City officials released a summary of this investigation into Police Chief Thigge's leadership. What was the law firm directed to investigate?
Yeah, so they were asked to look at four specific questions, although the investigation was not necessarily limited to those questions, but they were asked to investigate whether Thigge had been an effective leader and manager of the Cincinnati Police Department, whether she had been a leader within the context of city governments, working with elected officials as well as the city manager's office, including the kind of bigger goals that the city has relating to crime and public safety, whether Thigge had committed any infraction or a policy violation while police chief, and whether she had disregarded best practices in the running of the department to the detriment of public safety and crime prevention.
And what did this investigation conclude?
Well, the investigation summary report that has been released publicly says that they believe that Chief Thigge was not an effective leader of the department. This was supported by witnesses that were interviewed, as well as additional documents and other things in the investigation that we do not have yet have access to. But the law firm concluded that she was not an effective leader and said that their investigation supported the vast majority of witnesses who said that she had not been effective.
This summary report says that 32 witnesses were interviewed. What do we know about who was interviewed for this investigation?
We don't have a list of who was interviewed. We know, as you said, that Thigge was interviewed in addition to these 32 witnesses. We know that 42 people were asked to be interviewed and 32 responded. Some others said no, some just did not respond. We also know who was not interviewed based on our reporting. So Mayor Purville was not interviewed as part of this investigation. At least 6 of the 9 city council members were not interviewed. 2, Evan Nolan and Jeff Kramerding, declined to answer that question. And 1, Councilmember Scotty Johnson, did not respond to the question. I also reached out to City Manager Cheryl Long's office to see if she was interviewed, and their office did not get back to me.
Did Chief Thigge get to suggest witnesses to be interviewed for this?
Yes, she suggested 7 people to be reached out to. All were asked to interview as part of the investigation, and the summary report says 5 of those 7 that she suggested agreed to participate.
Chief Thigge's been on paid administrative leave since October. That was after City Manager Cheryl Long asked her to resign. What, remind us of what prompted all that? Was it related to the high-profile crime that Cincinnati had last year?
Well, at the time that all of this came out in October of last year when this process started, we didn't have direct answers to that. It was just kind of assumptions. But there was, of course, a very difficult summer in public safety. There were some very high-profile incidents. It was also leading up to an election that gained some national attention on these kind of high-profile incidents. So now we know from the summary report there are some specific incidents, including the situation that happened right before Chief Thigge was asked to resign and then shortly after put on paid leave, was a shooting on Fountain Square that involved a couple of juveniles as well as some adults. This was a shooting that happened in the early evening on Fountain Square. It was kind of an abnormal situation where obviously there were potential for lots of bystanders around. It was kind of a very difficult situation. We know from the summary report that Thigge says that Cheryl Long blamed her leadership, that could be blamed on that situation, or at least the police response to that situation.
Well, the summary does make some references to the summer of 2025, including that one. Can you tell how much her handling of the crime last summer was investigated? That wasn't super clear to me, I've got to confess.
It certainly was part of the investigation, but the extent of that investigation is unclear. So as we mentioned, we only have this summary report. We don't know who was interviewed. We don't know what other evidence was interviewed. I should say that what we do know is that the investigation included public press interviews as well as press conferences. So that's something that we know was part of the investigation. But there are lots of references to Thigge's handling of summer crime, especially, you know, what is often referenced as the summer safety plan. So this was something that city officials came forward with before the kind of very difficult situations that were happening over the summer and the late spring. The city manager, the mayor, and the police chief all kind of presented this united front in terms of this summer safety plan. Now we're seeing from the summary that Thigee told the investigators that this plan was not her idea. She was not really on board with it. She says it was the mayor's plan. Thigee told investigators that the data didn't support more resources being deployed in the Central Business District, for example. So she's saying that the data showed declines in violent crime and other crime in some places, and that data should always dictate where police resources go. We also know from this investigation that apparently Thigee did not want initially to accept the additional help from the state of Ohio. So this was, widely reported that the governor had offered assistance, especially from the State Highway Patrol. There is now a memorandum of understanding between the city and the state to use those resources. And apparently initially Thigee was very reluctant to accept that help. The investigation concluded that caused a delay in accepting that help, and that was a part of the concern.
Well, and I think we should note that there have been some other high-profile incidents since her being put on administrative leave. I mean, there were some arrests after opening day, for example. So
that's right.
There's still stuff going on. There was the shooting at the nightclub that the media has reported on extensively. The report also talked about the chief's communication style and her ability to work within the larger city government. Tell us more about what it said along those lines.
Yeah, I'd say communication was certainly a big theme of this report. So the report says that Thigee has this communication style that really relies on a very small inner circle to make decisions. So they're saying that she does not accept feedback and input from enough people, including those in city leadership. They say that her communication style within the department itself led to a lack of transparency and distrust. So, this is relating to decisions that were made. Some officers apparently reported that they learned about changes in the department from the media instead of from the chain of command, for example. And Thigee also reportedly attempted to block the city manager from communicating with command staff. Forcing all communication with city officials, administrative and elected, to go through her, and that this caused delays. And again, this concern about a lack of transparency. Hmm.
I think the report also did say call her strong administratively, though, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So it said that her administrative kind of prowess was strong, and that was a positive in her leadership. But that seemed to be, according to the report, overshadowed by these other concerns about her leadership.
The report also quotes Chief Thigee as saying she had not had a formal performance appraisal in 7 years. Is that accurate as far as you know?
I don't know information about that. We do still have the summary report was released in response to a public records request, but that request was only partially fulfilled. So we have an outstanding public records request for more information, including what you referenced.
Okay. And as you referenced, she did say the first time she was aware the city manager had trouble with her performance or had a problem with her performance was after that Fountain Square shooting, right? At least that's what's in the summary.
That's what's in the summary, yes. That was October 13th.
Yeah. And do you know, this might be another one of those things we don't know yet, but do you know if Chief Thigee was given any chance to improve her performance after she became aware of the city manager's concerns?
The timeline is unclear on that. So if it is accurate that Thigee was not told of any concerns about her leadership in mid-October, it seems, she was placed on paid leave almost immediately after that. So that would seem to say no. However, I believe the city manager would say that would disagree with that. And the summary itself, again, we don't know who was interviewed in terms of witnesses, but some witnesses said they did not believe it was accurate that Thigee had not been made aware of performance concerns. And so according to some of these unnamed witnesses, they believe that Thigee was given a chance to improve her performance.
What did this summary say about a culture of retaliation within the department and a perception of favoritism and nepotism?
Yeah, so I want to be clear that in generally speaking, this culture of retaliation and this perception of favoritism and nepotism, with some exceptions, it largely refers to issues that were not necessarily caused by Chief Thigee herself. But the report describes that Thigee was very dismissive of these concerns and that in her position as police chief, she should have given this more focus and should have addressed it. In terms of like favoritism and nepotism, for example, there were some questions about her nephew being given a preferred assignment, for example, and other situations. Now, Thigee has denied that she was involved in any of these decisions, but the concern that's pointed out in the report is largely that Thigee did not do enough to dissuade the department from these perceptions. So again, not necessarily saying that she did do anything wrong in terms of nepotism or favoritism, but that she should have worked harder to assure the department that those things were not going on, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. The summary also quotes some of these unnamed witnesses making comparisons between Chief Thigee and the city's interim police chief, Adam Henney, right?
Yes. So the few comments related to interim Chief Henney's leadership, including that he communicates well, it's claimed that he includes others in decision making, that he explains his decisions rather than using a, quote, because I said so approach, that he's more considerate of generational and cultural differences. Someone described Henney's leadership as a breath of fresh air. Others said he is very personable and said that his appointment has been very good for morale.
How has Chief Thigee's lawyer responded to this summary?
Well, as we've reported, the attorney for Chief Thigee was already denouncing this report 2 weeks ago before it was even released to the public or before they had seen it. So Stephen M. Affini Law Firm had said they expected this to be a, quote, hatchet job. And that was based on the questions, I believe, that were asked of Chief Thigee during that investigation. Once the report was shared with Thigee and her attorney, Stephen M., they have said that it is full of falsehoods and outrageous allegations. They say they are looking forward to Thigee defending herself against the allegations, and they say there is no evidence to support the city's allegations and actions against her so far.
Have city officials commented on this at all? I guess I wonder if you heard anything from the city manager, the mayor, members of council.
The city manager manager has declined to say any more. She says it's an ongoing personnel matter. We know from Thigee's attorney, not from the city manager herself, that Thigee has been asked for a pre-disciplinary hearing with the city manager, although we're not sure when that will take place. Mayor Pirval said it would not be appropriate for him to comment. He has consistently said this is an administrative choice. And per the charter, that is accurate. This is the city manager's job to decide who leads these departments. But the mayor did say that the city manager has his full support in conducting and completing this review process.
Well, there is other potential trouble ahead for Cincinnati Police Department because of the city's projected budget deficit. How big is that projected deficit?
The projected deficit in the general fund is $29.5 million. Now, that is significant. It's not the largest deficit the city has faced in the last decade or so, but it's certainly larger than recent years. It's also the largest deficit the city has had to face since going through all of the federal stimulus money. So there were large deficits in the early days or early years after during the COVID pandemic, but the city was able to easily address that with federal stimulus. And of course, that's no longer an option now.
And I know the city manager asked departments to estimate 5.1% budget cuts, cuts in their own budgets. How much would that be for the police department?
Well, according to Interim Chief Henney, a 5.1% cut would be nearly $11 million. It's worth noting that public safety is the largest portion of the general fund. That's police and fire combined. Nearly $11 million for the police department is what would have to be cut if they had a full 5.1% cut.
Did Interim Chief Henney offer a different cost-cutting plan?
Yeah, Henney basically presented to City Council's Budget, Finance, and Governance Committee with a plan to cut about $6.6 million. That's obviously not a full 5.1% cut. They would be able to reach that by not filling current vacant positions. That would save about $3.8 million. He says there's about $250,000 in miscellaneous cuts. And then the other option was to delay the next recruit class that is scheduled for fiscal year 27. That's the budget that they're considering now. And the idea would be to delay that recruit class until the 2028 fiscal year budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of the department's budget is personnel, right? So would cutting more than what the plan that Interim Chief Henney proposed, would that mean cutting police officers?
So yes, 90% of the police department's budget is personnel. So Henney said it was very difficult to find cuts that don't impact positions. Now, keep in mind, they're looking first at vacant positions. So that's not layoffs. It's just not filling positions that otherwise would be there. Henney did say that a full 5.1% cut would include layoffs, but it's unclear at this point how many and whether those would be sworn officers, or the department also has other non-sworn officers, sort of administrative staff.
The police department doesn't have a full complement of sworn officers now, does it?
That's right. And they haven't for quite some time. And this has been a very difficult situation. It requires a lot of overtime pay because there aren't enough sworn officers to cover all of the essential functions of the police department. But of course, in addition to that, all of the additional work that went in based on the summer safety concerns last year that have continued over this year. So the department is about 100 officers short of the current sworn complement. And that number fluctuates constantly as more officers retire or resign or move to other departments.
How did council members react to this presentation? Do they expect potentially deep budget cuts to public safety?
I think deep cuts to public safety are unlikely. Budget Chair Jeff Kramerding told me he does not expect a 5% cut to the police department or to public safety in general, which would include the fire department. Councilmember Seth Walsh pointed out, and others have echoed this, that delaying the recruit class, for example, which that would be under even a less than 5% cut that would be necessary, that could just exacerbate the budget issues that are ongoing. Again, the problem with having not enough officers is one of the problems is this reliance on overtime pay. And delaying a recruit class, which would be 50 officers or up to 50 officers, could only exacerbate that problem. So it may not end up being a cost savings in the long run anyway. So I think the recruit class is something very unlikely to be delayed. So it seems council, this council, but in the historical context of other councils as well, they tend to find cuts elsewhere in the budget to keep public safety safe.
Well, so if public safety doesn't get deep cuts, what would that mean for other city departments? They get deeper cuts?
Yes, unless the situation changes, you know, especially because public safety, police, and fire are, as I said, the largest portion, more than 60% of the general fund budget. So if you don't cut 5% from each of those departments, you would need to cut deeper cuts from other departments. Now, things can change between now and when the budget draft is available. So we may not be, revenue may come in higher than was originally expected in December, which is the latest information that this budget deficit is estimated on. So it may be that that number of cuts is not necessary, or that level of cuts is not necessary, but that's just a big question mark right now. We don't know yet.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter, Becca Costello. Thanks so much for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, what went wrong for prosecutors in the First Energy bribery trial? This is Cincinnati Edition. Powerful political figures have faced legal consequences for the First Energy bribery scandal. Will the company's CEO and senior vice president? You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss the case and the trial that ended this week is Signal Ohio State House reporter Jake Zuckerman. Welcome back, Jake.
Thank you for having me on again.
Well, we appreciate your time today. You spent weeks in Akron covering the First Energy bribery trial. Remind us briefly who was on trial and what they were accused of.
For sure. Not the most important point in the world, but I did Zoom the trial from Columbus.
Okay, good. I appreciate that correction.
Yes. Myself here. I'm sorry. So this trial was the CEO of First Energy. He was the CEO from 2015 to 2020. That's Chuck Jones. And the senior vice president of external affairs. So the top lobbyist for the, you know, very regulated company, Mike Dowling. And they were both on trial. They faced seven charges that were generally predicated around the company's financial relationship with Sam Randazzo when he was a private attorney, and then an alleged bribe the company via those two men paid to Sam Randazzo in 2019 when Governor Mike DeWine appointed him to lead the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, which regulates all utilities, including First Energy.
Well, this is the same company that was tied to the case involving former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I think the easiest way to think about this is that there are basically two accusations, both of which First Energy as a company has admitted to, which is that they paid what's described as a $60 million bribe to ex-Speaker of the House, Larry Householder. That was a period of time between really 2017 and 2019, depending how you count it. And then there's this separate, what's described as a $4.3 million bribe paid to Sam Randazzo in January 2019. Both of what the company really wanted here is an economic solution for its nuclear plants. They're the only two nuclear plants in the state of Ohio, and they were just losing money quarter after quarter because they really just couldn't compete with the natural gas boom that has occurred in the region over the past 15, 20 years. So they're two separate alleged bribery schemes. Larry Householder is in prison for his receipt of the bribe. The federal government has charged these two men in connection with bribing Larry Householder. The state government did not. So the trial that occurred in Akron is essentially half of the bribery scheme, and it only focused on Sam Randazzo, and I'm happy to get into why.
Yeah. Well, and this trial that in Akron, it ended with a hung jury?
Yes, it ended with a hung jury, leading the judge to declare a mistrial. You know, the jury deliberations are secret by design, so there's only so much we can ever really know about what went on in there. But I have spoken to two jurors, and about six declined to comment after the trial. In their defense, this was a very long and slog of a trial, so no hard feelings there. But from the two jurors that spoke, it sounds like the jury, depending on the charge and really the day of the week, they were somewhere between 9-3 and 10-2 in favor of convictions. So on the one hand, a super majority of the jury wanted to send these two men to prison. On the other hand, in our constitutional system, you need 12 of 12 to agree, and they did not get that, so the prosecutors failed.
What did lawyers for the defendants argue?
Yeah, so the charges are a bit complicated by nature, so I'm sorry if this explanation is like what hearing paint dry. But the money was paid to Sam Randazzo in January 2019. It was $4.3 million. It was paid from First Energy to a company that only Randazzo controlled. It had no employees. You know, effectively, it was paid to Sam. But what the two defendants have argued is that to really understand the transaction, it comes back to a 2015 contract between First Energy and the Industrial Energy Users of Ohio, which were Mr. Randazzo's legal clients. And basically, when First Energy wants to raise costs for customers, there's a court-like proceeding that happens at the PUCO. And the Industrial Energy Users of Ohio, these are huge, huge energy buyers like Marathon Petroleum, the University of Akron for a time, Timken Steel, you know, people who buy at hyperscale. And they put their buying power together and try to pressure First Energy to lower costs, really for them and their members, more so than for the broader state of Ohio. And so there's just kind of a food fight and cost-shifting war that happens at the PUCO. And basically, First Energy reached what's known as a side deal with IEU, where essentially we pay you some money and you agree not to oppose us politically at the PUCO. And the PUCO takes non-opposition from entities like the Industrial Energy Users as a sign that, look, there's real negotiation going on between the parties. Everyone has reached an agreement. So it's a very powerful symbol. And the two defendants in Akron argued that what happened here is we paid this money with every intent of it going to Mr. Randazzo's legal clients. Sam Randazzo stole that money. So we could not have bribed him because we never believed him to be the recipient of the funds. His clients were. And that's a notion the prosecutor strenuously disagreed on. And Sam Randazzo died by suicide in April of 2024 while under state and federal indictment. So, you know, whether one believes it or not, the two defendants blamed the dead guy, just to put it simply. And we didn't get to hear Sam Randazzo defend itself. So there was a big hole in the alleged conspiracy.
Well, federal prosecutors won a conviction against Larry Householder in 2023. what, as far as you can tell, what went wrong for prosecutors in Akron, the state prosecutors in Akron? Was it partly just the complexity of the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of things. I don't think it's any one factor, but I think some of it comes to strategic decisions that the prosecution made. For instance, like you said, you know, the prosecutors knew perfectly well that the federal government's theory here, criminal theory, worked for at least one jury, but they did not charge the Larry householder side of the crime here. And I think that, you know, at the time these charges were filed, there was a bit of uncertainty of, okay, so you can win at a jury, but what the Supreme Court and the federal courts are very receptive to the idea of money and speech. Money is speech in politics, and government laws cannot restrict speech under the First Amendment. So by skipping the householder stuff, I think they avoided that risk. But on the other hand, they left on the table this theory and all this evidence that at least worked once in Cincinnati. So I think that has to be part of it. You know, there were some rulings they didn't like from the judge. I get one clear contrast is at Larry householder's trial, an FBI special agent named Blaine Wetzel, who has a background in state house politics. He was a witness. He testified for maybe 3 or 4 days, and he sort of narrated the government's whole case. And then after Blaine testified, out came a bunch of fact witnesses who largely corroborated his testimony. And you know, Blaine Wetzel explained how he went through bank records and how he went through emails and what he thought they meant. And in the state case, there was going to be an agent from the Bureau of Criminal Investigations to testify. That agent was actually found, he was administratively found, so there were no criminal charges filed, but to have tampered with evidence on unrelated cases. But he was since fired, and he declined to testify at the case. The defense wanted him to testify because he'd be a perfectly good way to bloody up the state's case. He declined to testify, citing his Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. So for one, the state did not have a narrator. And for two, you know, it's just not a good look for prosecutors when there's suspicions of criminal activity, you know, within the staff. Obviously, it's a huge problem. So you had stuff like that. By my analysis, I'd say that there was just a huge lopsided labor split here. There were 17 defense attorneys between the two defendants that were appearing on court documents. There seemed to be more in the courthouse. It's hard. People don't always want to identify themselves, you know, in courthouses or what their interest is in a trial, which is their right. But so the defense attorneys were splitting up the workload in this very visible way. They were splitting up witnesses. In my interviews with lawyers, you know, they can split up objections. You can have one lawyer making an objection and four associates, you know, quickly doing legal research to back up and bulletproof this objection. Well, the prosecutors are really just left to think on their feet much more. So I don't know that there's any one thing that differentiated these cases, but more a mosaic.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of lawyers for the defense. Who's paying for all those lawyers?
Yeah, so we don't have a firm answer to that question, but the state has represented that First Energy has indemnified basically the two defendants and all its former employees. So in short, that would mean First Energy is paying the bills unless these men are convicted, in which case they could try to reclaw the money or they could just cut off the legal spigot. So that remains to be seen, but it is First Energy. And just to underscore, you know, if you or I got a DUI or whatever the legal trouble, these are not the lawyers that you and I are going to call. You know, these are huge law firms, the kinds that have high-rise buildings in Cleveland, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Chicago. Those are real cities where these lawyers came in from. One of them was Carol Rendon, who under Barack Obama was appointed to serve as U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Ohio. She was confirmed by the Senate. One of them was George Stambulidis, who as a prosecutor in New York, at least one and maybe two of the five families were prosecuted under his leadership. So it's 40% of the mafia families in New York he led the prosecution of. So these are like really storied lawyers, hugely, hugely expensive lawyers. Fancy. Bill Sherman was the chief of staff of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So it's besides just the number of lawyers, these are super lawyers or whatever you want to call them. There was a certain cartoonishness of the, you know, like the CEO on trial and this army of lawyers at his back.
Yeah. You have a very thorough and detailed analysis on the Signal Ohio website that gets into way more of this. So I'd refer our listeners to that if they want to learn more. But you also note that, you know, the judge made some unusual comments during the trial, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. They were coming through the trial and they caught my ears. They caught the ears of some other people who were paying attention. I think one of the first notable ones, there's a woman named Eileen Mickelson, who is the director of rates for First Energy. And she is implicitly accused of having concealed this side deal between First Energy and the Industrial Energy Users of Ohio. She was granted immunity in the case, so she cannot be criminally charged for the contents of her testimony. And during her testimony, Chuck Jones said something to her at lunch and the prosecutors noticed. You know, this is like a lunchroom conversation, but there really should not be contact between defendants and witnesses. And the prosecution, you know, asked for an explanation really from the witness. And Judge Ross made these comments to the effect, oh, he didn't mean it. It was probably like saying hello, which may well be true, but that's really for Chuck Jones or for Eileen Mickelson to say. It's not for the judge to make that assumption and say it publicly. It was just a very unusual moment. But I think the most significant came, you know, like human beings were just the way our brains work. We remember the first thing on the list and the last thing on the list and tend to forget the middle. And prosecutors get the chance to speak first in closing arguments and last in closing arguments. And when Matt Meyer, the assistant attorney general, was making his closing arguments, he said that there was an unsigned contract. And to spare some details here, First Energy produced 20 million documents, more than 20 million documents for this trial and for all the legal trials coming out of this stuff. And in the contract between First Energy and Sam Randazzo, no one has seen, no one has definitively said that they have seen a signed copy of it. No signed copy of the contract ever made it into evidence. You know, it's hard to speak to the non-existence of something. How can anyone say with certainty that a thing does not exist? But there's almost no reason to believe it does exist. And when Matt Meyer used the term unsigned, it prompted these objections. And the judge sided with them, but in front of the jury and prosecutors and really any lawyers are very, very sensitive to comments from a judge in front of the jury. She said, and I'll just quote directly here, including a misstatement in her quote, "The evidence is no one has seen a signed agreement. No one has said that it was not signed, not one witness. If you want, I'll continue to state what I think the evidence is, which I'm sure you don't want me to do. So let's stick to what the evidence actually shows." Hmm. And she said it with a lot of hostility in my hearing of the events. And it's just, that's just a really salty taste to leave in the jury's mouth, is this sort of tisk-tisk from a judge to a prosecutor saying, you are misrepresenting the evidence to the jury. It's just not the sort of thing that would convey confidence in a reasonable juror that a prosecutor is telling the truth. It's coming from a figure of authority. It was a very unusual comment to me, and it really stuck out. So I thought it was worth including here.
Yeah. Well, I have been talking with Signal Ohio State House reporter Jake Zuckerman. I know you'll be all over the retrial if one happens. Thanks so much for your time today, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
Up next, what fans can expect from the Reds this season. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's spring for real in Cincinnati because baseball is back. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the Reds and the outlook for the season is Local 12 News digital sports columnist and editor and host of the Skinny podcast, Richard Skinner. Welcome back, Skinny.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
A young player, the Reds' rookie first baseman, was named this year's first National League Player of the Week. Tell us about him.
Yeah, that's Sal Stewart. He's the guy that I wrote a prediction column, 10 bold predictions. We all do it in the business, and probably five of them are right and five of them are alarmingly wrong. But one of the predictions was that I think he's going to be rookie of the year. He came up late last year, got 58 at bats, hit five home runs, and he's just been a guy who's been ticketed all along since he came into the organization as a guy who they expected to do some great things. He's only 21 years old. So you take that as kind of a small sample size, but you also say, listen, this is a guy who's hit. He's hit big. And then lo and behold, coming out of spring training, Terry Francona did a rare thing, the Reds manager. He put him in the cleanup spot. He put a rookie in the cleanup spot in an order of a team coming off of a playoff season, which tells you how much he believes in Sal Stewart. The only other time he's done that in his career, he put a guy named Scott Rolen in the cleanup spot, and Scott Rolen had a great career. He did that when he was a rookie. And he's off to a great start, 9 for 19 so far this year. He's really carried this offense. He and Eugenio Suarez, with a couple of big swings of the bat, really carried this offense. And I don't feel justified yet, because you don't win an award one week into the season, but at least the prediction's trending in the right direction.
Well, that's the good news. What about opening day? That was not the result fans wanted to see.
Yeah, they faced a pitcher, Garrett Crochet, who was runner-up for American League Cy Young last year. So that's one of those you can chalk up as, hey, that's just a great pitcher who got the better of you on that day. But it is disappointing, because they really hit well out in Goodyear, Arizona in spring training. They led all of Major League Baseball in home runs in the spring. And spring stats can be very misleading, because you don't know, are they hitting him off guys who are now in the minors? Was the wind blowing out a bunch on certain days? But bottom line was, you felt good about this offense coming into this year because Sal Stewart was being plugged into the lineup, because you went out and signed Eugenio Suarez, who hit 49 home runs last season. And to fall flat like that was disappointing. I chalked that one up more to a great pitcher. But so far through the first six games, this offense has been woeful other than Sal Stewart. I mentioned he's 9 for 19. If you take him out of the mix, the rest of the lineup is hitting 145 through the first six games. That's probably an anomaly. But it was an offense that struggled at times last year. You thought, okay, you're going to get some guys taking steps forward. Sal Stewart gives you something. Suarez will give you something. And so far, unfortunately, it's fallen flat through the first six games of the year.
Well, the Reds didn't blow a lead this opening day like they did last year. Is that a silver lining at all?
True. Although, the bullpen had a shaky spring and had a shaky opener, and so that looked like a bad trend. But really, bullpen's been pretty good, other than a couple of guys. Emilio Pagan is not the closer from last year, has not had a good first few outings. Pierce Johnson, who they got in the offseason, a curveball specialist, has not been good. But for the most part, rest of the bullpen's been pretty good. But on that opening day, actually, it was the bullpen that allowed all three runs to the Red Sox. Andrew Abbott pitched six shutout innings, and then the bullpen gave up three runs in three innings.
So overall, how's the Reds pitching looking to you this season, and how do you feel about the bullpen?
Well, you do start off with not having probably your two best pitchers on paper. Hunter Green's out until July because of having bone spurs removed from his elbow. And then Nick Lodolo, the left-hander, started the year on the injured list because of some blister issues that he keeps having on his left index finger. He's a left-handed pitcher, so that's a problem. So you start two down. The silver lining, though, is you got to plug in your 2023 first-round pick and your 2024 first-round pick into the rotation, Rhett Lauder and Chase Burns. Lauder came up in 2024, made six starts, and had a 1.17 ERA. Now, he missed all of last year due to an oblique injury, an oblique issue. So he missed last season. So he had a great, healthy spring, really threw the ball well, had a great first start. Chase Burns is a guy that people around baseball will tell you probably has top 10 stuff, for lack of a better term, and maybe even better than that type of stuff. It's just a matter of harnessing some of that. So the silver lining was, you do have arguably your two best pitchers out, but you got a chance to plug in two kids that you get to see extended looks at, and I think that's a good thing. The other part to it is, you know, Hunter Green only made 19 starts last year. He's not made more than 26 starts in a season, so you kind of go into a season knowing you're probably not going to have him for some stretches for whatever reason. Well, you don't have him to start. The silver lining would be, he's got bone chips removed. He's going to come back healthy. It probably won't be till July. You can still probably get 15 starts out of him, and you're almost adding an all-star caliber pitcher to your roster down the stretch if you can stay afloat and stay in the playoff race until then. So the starting staff has depth. That depth's kind of eroded a little bit now just because of Green and Lodolo being out. Lodolo should be back probably sooner rather than later. And then they'll have to make a decision if they're going to go six starters for five spots, which they had talked about doing when the season started. As for the bullpen, I think that's the spot that's still shaky for me. I mentioned two guys really haven't pitched well. The rest have, but I need to see more. I need to see consistency. I think that's the weak link in my mind at the moment. Although through six games, statistically, it's been the offense has been the complete weak link.
How is the team looking defensively?
Defensively, I think they're much better. You've got Key Brian Hazy, you got last year in a trade from Pittsburgh, third baseman who's been a perennial Gold Glove third baseman, arguably the best defensive third baseman in the league. The problem is he just doesn't hit. He's never really hit. He's 1-for-15 to start this year. I think they believe that, listen, our lineup 1-8 is going to be good enough to carry a weak bat in the ninth spot because he's going to save some runs defensively. Ellie De La Cruz, the shortstop, played hurt with a kind of a hurt quad hamstring issue for a good chunk of last year that compromised him both at the plate and defensively. And Matt McClain was coming off shoulder surgery where he was not himself defensively or offensively, and he's back fully healthy. And so now suddenly you're up the middle combination is much, much better defensively. Noelia Marte is still a work in progress in right field after he got moved from third base. TJ Friedl, who I think is a good defensive center fielder, hasn't been great so far this year, but they do have a guy named Dane Myers who I'm not so sure if before long he's not the regular center fielder. Friedl continues to struggle at the plate the way he has. And left field is one of those you throw a probably a weak link defender out there, but you can at the end of games if you're leading, you can put Friedl in left, put Dane Myers in center, and suddenly you would put a Will Benson in right. Suddenly you have a very strong defensive outfield along with a really strong defensive infield. So I do think they're better defensively. It's something they tried to start doing last year because they realized they were really weak in a bunch of different spots. They gave up, I think, the fifth most unearned runs in baseball last season. Gave up 68, and cut down on that a little bit. That's going to help. So I think they are on paper a much better defensive team.
You just mentioned Ellie De La Cruz and Matt McClain, two players that I know a lot of fans are following and who had some trouble last year. How are they looking this season?
Well, Matt McClain had the most ridiculous spring of springs. He had a batting average over 500, a slugging percentage over 1,000. He led all of Major League Baseball in the spring in home runs with 7. And he looked just like the guy that came up in 2023 in the 90-game stint that he played. When he had 16 home runs, hit 290, was on pace if he played a full season to score over 100 runs, drive in 90 runs. He then missed 2024 because of injuries, didn't play at all. Last year came back and probably was a little compromised by the injury, got off to a bad start, really started to press at the plate, and he was pretty much a lost cause. He did play 150-some-odd games almost by default. So then kind of took a fresh approach at the plate this spring, really worked hard on laying off pitches that caused him trouble last year, started trying to take the ball more to the right side than he did and started showing power to the opposite field. And it really looked like, okay, this is the guy we saw in 2023. Unfortunately, it hasn't resulted in a very good start for him. He's hitting under 200 to start the year. He has drawn a bunch of walks, so he's getting on base. And again, I'm hoping this is just the small sample size and that he doesn't press. He's faced two great starting pitchers so far. They faced Paul Skenes of the Pirates on Wednesday afternoon, and Paul Skenes arguably has the best stuff in the game, at least top three stuff. And I mentioned Garrett Crochet was a runner-up for the Cy Young in the American League last year. So you faced two top, not just good starters, two top flight, top end, as good as they get starters in Garrett Crochet and Paul Skenes. So, you know, maybe there's a little bit of that. I hope that he doesn't start pressing because I think what we saw in the spring, the flashes of what we saw in the spring are what he's about. I've liked him, believe it or not, more than De La Cruz since he came up. I just think he's got a chance to be a more consistent player. I think Ellie's that shining star, that shooting star, that, man, when he does some stuff, it is just off the charts spectacular. Is it consistent enough? Ellie's also off to a bit of a struggling start at the plate. He has hit 2 home runs. I think, you know, that injury last year really compromised him, as I mentioned, both offensively and defensively. It kind of robbed him of any power. He only hit 22 home runs. And I say, you know, a lot of people have written about his year last year, talked about his year last year, kind of, and I put this in quotation marks, Lucy, call it disappointing year. Yet he led this team in homers, runs scored, RBIs, stolen bases, made the All-Star game. And oh, by the way, he was only 23 years old. And you got to keep refreshing yourself on that. Listen, he's still a work in progress. So yeah, through the first 6 games, the numbers haven't been eye-popping, but he has belted a couple of home runs. And again, some of this, I'll chalk a little bit of this up to you. Again, face 2, just off the charts, great starting pitchers.
How deep is the bench this season for the Reds?
That's a great question. It's deep enough to where you've got the Dane Myers, as I mentioned, and the platoon with Friedl probably coming sooner rather than later. Myers is a right-handed bat. Friedl's a left-handed bat. Nathaniel Lowe, who hit 18 homers last year and drove in 84 runs for the Red Sox, he doesn't hit for average much. He's a left-handed hitter. They kept him around because he has some power and he's a lefty bat off the bench. He got a a start on Wednesday against Skeens and did have an RBI double. And that's kind of what you're hoping to do is when there's a tough righty on the mound, you're the left-handed bat that can maybe with one big swing do some damage for us. Jose Trevino is a terrific backup catcher. That's the perfect guy to have in that role. And then Will Benson gives you a left-handed power bat off the bench too. And he, when he doesn't start, then Noel V. Marte gives you a right-handed, solid right-handed bat off the bench. They're pretty deep in AAA, especially in the outfield. Reese Hines, who's had a cup of coffee up here and had a really good spring. There just wasn't room for him. He's off to a good start down in Louisville. One of their top prospects, Hector Rodriguez, is there. Another guy who I don't know where he fits defensively. He is an outfielder. He's not a great outfielder. A guy named J.J. Bladé has had some good moments in the major leagues as well, but he's down at AAA. I mean, you have a pseudo major league starting outfield down there, so that's good depth. There's some good live arms down in Louisville as well, Chase Petty among them. So you've, as I mentioned, you've kind of tapped into your pitching depth because of the injuries to Lodolo and to Hunter Green. But you do have a little bit of depth down there, and then when they come back, that'll expand your depth. So I do think the depth is pretty good on this roster and at the AAA level too.
Okay. Well, as of the time we're recording this, Thursday morning, the Reds have 3 wins, 3 losses. How many games do you think this team can win this year?
So in that prediction column I mentioned,
we lost you there, Skinny. Broke up a little bit.
About that. I am getting 90 wins. It's probably pie in the sky. And I look at it from this perspective. There's a formula that you can kind of gauge called the Pythagorean record formula, where you take the number of runs you score versus the number of runs you give up, and it gives you a win total. And so I mentioned a little bit better defense. I think a little bit better pitching than last year when they were good. They were 11th in Major League Baseball in ERA. If they can get the number from 686 runs allowed down to 650, I don't think that's a big jump to take. I think they're capable of that. And this offense, I think, is going to be better than last year, even though it's off to a slow start. They scored 716 runs last year. I mentioned if they can get it to 750, if you score 750, you give up 650, that gives you 92 wins in the Pythagorean record. It's not an exact science, but usually they're close to that. So I'm going to stick with the 90 wins, even though they're off to the 3-3 start.
Overall, are you feeling optimistic, pessimistic? Is it too early to say?
Well, I'm optimistic going into this year. I really like this team. I mean, it was a playoff team last year that had flaws. They fixed some of those flaws. I expect some of the young guys to get better. I do think a healthy Ellie makes a huge difference. The signing of Suarez, I mean, he won a game for him over the weekend with one swing of the bat. They're down 2-0, two men on. He hits a 3-run homer, and they win 3-2. He's going to strike out a lot. He's not going to hit for average, but if he can get you 30 to 35 home runs, a big bat that you didn't have last year, I think that gets you 3 to 4 more wins right there. He's already gotten you one. So now you're asking for maybe two or three more with a long season still ahead. So I'm still very, very optimistic about this team.
Well, I've been talking with Local 12 News digital sports columnist and editor and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Thanks so much for your time today, Skinny.
Thanks as always, Lucy. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.